KALW.
Martin's Beach is a gem. It's one of the most beautiful places on the planet, and it needs to be treated as such.
A prime piece of California coastline is back in the news, bringing up issues of privacy versus public access.
I would say the gate never really opened back up. We're walking through here, but it's random. So it's been on and off, cat and mouse game.
We'll hear the latest in the fight over Martin's Beach. Then we get an update on the state of the monarch butterflies.
So this year, everyone's really been holding their breath to see what are the numbers going to be.
And a new interview from Solano State Prison about a guy who used to be a professional arborist.
I see a lot of people trying to be gangsters, and my mindset is, man, I could take you to this spot where I know you won't be gangster, and it's at the top of a 90-foot palm tree.
I'm Hena Baba, and this is Cross Currents. If you've tried to visit Martin's Beach near Half Moon Bay in the last decade, you may have gotten stopped at a gate on the only road that leads to the shore. The road is on property owned by billionaire venture capitalist Vinod Khosla, who controls access to the beach. Well, last week, the California Attorney General filed a lawsuit against Khosla, saying he's been, quote, improperly and illegally restricting public access. Now, a little background. When Khosla bought the property back in 2008, he initially kept the gate locked. In 2013, he lost a lawsuit and was forced to give partial access. Now, the California Coastal Commission wants him to remove the no trespassing signs and take out the gate altogether. In the story from our archives, reporter Marco Seiler Gonzalez takes us to Martin's Beach to learn more.
An early morning drive from San Francisco to Martin's Beach is nothing short of epic. You drive along the massive cliffs that tower above Gray Whale Cove, then you pass Montara Beach, where the highway winds through a grove of tall trees and shoots you out into sprawling farmland and open fields. The turnoff for Martin's Beach comes abruptly. I park on the dirt lot next to the paved road that leads a little less than half a mile down to the beach. That's where I meet Edmundo Larenas.
Yeah. Will we be driving down or walking down?
I think we should walk.
Sure, yeah.
If I'll you're good with that.
Definitely.
If you have anything that looks valuable in your car, put it in the trunk, because this is like...
Yeah. No, I get it.
Larenas is the co-founder of the Surfrider Foundation's San Mateo County chapter. The foundation sued Vinod Khosla back in 2013 for limiting public access to Martin's Beach without applying for a permit. Khosla locked the gate. He reopened it last year, sometimes, after the California Coastal Commission threatened to fine him $11,000 a day for violating the Coastal Act.
I would say the gate never really opened back up. We're walking through here, but it's random. And the reason that's important is because if you live anywhere where you have to spend time to drive here, you want to be able to come here and have a guarantee that the gate's going to be open. So it's been on and off, cat and mouse game.
Khosla bought these 89 acres surrounding Martin's Beach in 2008. He often closes the gate to the only road in, but that hasn't stopped folks like Larenas from enjoying this piece of the coast.
A friend of mine and I got on our surfboards and we paddled. It's about a mile from the next public access to this beach, so we got on our surfboards and paddled over here just to make a point.
The tall bluffs on either side of Martin's Beach frame the seemingly endless blue ocean. It feels like you're standing on the edge of the earth. The road snakes down into a small neighborhood of cottages above the beach. Khosla owns it all.
So check this out. As you walk along here, you're going to see the iconic shark fin rock to your right. It's to the north of the beach. There it is. Now tell me that's not worth protecting, huh?
It is beautiful, but get this. Khosla almost never sees it. He told the New York Times he hasn't spent a night at Martin's Beach. He said he regrets buying the land in the first place.
Mr. Khosla bought this property in order to close that gate. According to the Coastal Act, any change in use is considered development. And any development, if you're in the coastal zone, needs a coastal development permit, and he never applied for it. In fact, he basically said, well, sue me.
Khosla declined to talk with me, but he did explain his reasoning in an interview with Bloomberg News.
It's about property rights and about a set of people who want to use coercion In fact, they told me they'd like to embarrass me into giving up my rights. Well, if you have a belief system, even though it's unpopular, even though the press all knocks you for it, you want to live by your principles. Whether it's that or protecting private property rights and fighting for what the law is, and when it's not clear, and there's clearly some things that are not clear in the law, it's important to get them legally resolved.
The road down to Martins Beach hasn't always been contentious. In fact, it used to be quite inviting. There was once a huge red sign along Highway 1 that pointed out the beach to passersby. The local Dini family bought the property in the early 1900s. A few decades later, they leased it to another family who began allowing visitors down to the beach for a small fee. The Dini family continued that tradition when they took the property over again in the 90s. To bring that passage back, the State Lands Commission is considering buying the access road from Kosla. He said he'd only sell it for $30 million. That's nearly the amount he bought the entire property for. But some local residents are wary that if the road were open permanently, the public would fall short of keeping their prized beach pristine. Local business owner Brian Overfelt says he's seen mounds of trash at Tunitas Creek. That's the San Mateo County beach just south of Martins.
I'm not seeing our beaches being respected on both sides of Martins Beach. So I don't know if the public deserves access if that's the way the public's going to treat our beaches. Martins Beach is a gem. It's one of the most beautiful places on the planet, and it needs to be treated as such.
Overfelt owns the old Princeton Landing in Half Moon Bay and has lived in the area since he was three. He says he wasn't even mad when Kosla closed the gate in the first place, and it gave him a greater appreciation for the time he spent down there with the Dini family.
My favorite memory is I was sitting inside the little, when you go down to Martins Beach, there's a little group of buildings, and in the one building was a little general store, and they had three beers on tap, and they had soda pop, and they had water, and they had food you could buy. And my favorite memory ever was I just got done surfing all afternoon. I was all surfed out, I was salty, and I was sitting next to Jimmy Dini, of the Dini family that sold the property to the Kuchlas, drinking cold beer, and I just surfed all day. And I go, this is like the most amazing thing ever. And when all that went away, because the Dinis left or sold the property, they're still around, but they sold the property, and that ended, and the gate was closed. To me, that was the signal of an end of a beautiful era.
Today, the little cafe that used to sell burgers and beer is boarded up and shut down. It's another reminder the era that Overfelt remembered so fondly is over. But the legal battle over this beach will go on. At Martins Beach, I'm Marco Salar Gonzalez for Cross Currents.
That story originally aired in October 2018. You can learn more about Martins Beach and the controversy at klw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Now we're going to head a little farther down the California coast. Over the weekend, experts and enthusiasts from all over the country met in Carmel to discuss the state of the monarch. And no, they weren't discussing the shocking news that Prince Harry and Meghan are stepping back from royal life. They were talking about monarch butterflies, whose numbers have been in a steep decline over the last couple of years. And here to give us a report back from the summit is KALW science reporter Marissa Ortega-Welch. Hey, Marissa.
Hi, Hannah.
Hi. So, Marissa, the monarchs are these big, beautiful orange and black butterflies. I'm a little biased because my kid's school mascot is the monarch.
Oh.
Go Delane Easton Monarchs. But you tell us about them.
That's amazing. So, for the most part, monarchs on the East Coast migrate down to Mexico, and then monarchs on the West Coast spend their time inland up north, and then they migrate down to California in the winter to spend the winter here because it's warmer. Mm-hmm. And people love going to see them at places like Natural Bridges in Santa Cruz or the Pacific Grove Sanctuary near Monterey or at parks around San Francisco and the East Bay, maybe some parks near your kiddo's school.
Mm-hmm. And so you are our resident monarch
reporter. Can you give us the backstory? What's been happening to them?
Right. So to remind people, their numbers have been in decline since the 80s. But listeners might remember that last year, the monarchs in California made the news because they had a really steep decline in their population. Mm-hmm. Scientists had gotten together and said, okay, well, what would be the number below which, you know, monarch populations might not be able to bounce back from, like the number below which they might go extinct? Mm-hmm. And they came up with this number, 30,000.
Okay.
And last year, the Western population dropped below that number.
Okay, that's last year. What about this year?
So this year, everyone's really been holding their breath to see what are the numbers going to be. Scientists and community members go out and count monarchs at Thanksgiving and at New Year's. And the official data has yet to be released, but researchers released the estimates at the summit that I went to this weekend.
All right, so what's the news?
Do you want the good news, the bad news, or the really bad news first?
Well, let's not go for the really bad news. Let's start with something else.
Well, the good news and the bad news are kind of related. The bad news is that estimates are showing that the numbers for this year's count are as low as last year's count. So we're not seeing a rebound from last year.
Okay, why are the numbers declining?
Well, a lot of the conference was dedicated to talking about that. And one scientist said, there's no one smoking gun here. But the big ones are habitat loss, their winter sites here on the coast are being developed, or farmland where they might breed or feed are being converted into housing developments, like in the Central Valley, for example. Mm-hmm. Pesticides are another big one. The caterpillars eat milkweed plants, and a lot of milkweed is contaminated by pesticides. And of course, the big one, climate change, dry and warmer conditions.
Okay, so I'm guessing the good news is that it's not getting better, but it's not getting worse either.
Yeah, exactly. So we didn't see a decline from last year. The numbers stayed roughly the same. They're stable. And that's good. That's promising. That gives scientists some hope. Another thing that I thought was interesting is one scientist said that it's good news that the decline isn't just caused by climate change, because, you know, when people hear climate change, we sort of feel like, well, there's nothing we can do about that. It feels inevitable. Mm. But the fact that the decline is also caused by habitat loss, there's something tangible that we can do about that, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The other good news is that people really care about this insect. I mean, more than 100 people got together and, you know, spent a weekend talking about what we can do to try to save this insect.
It was a monarch summit.
Right.
Who comes to a monarch summit? So tell us.
So it was a really interesting mix, actually. There were people from all over the country, from Massachusetts, San Diego. There was even someone from Hawaii, all gathered together in one room. There was a lot of monarch paraphernalia.
Ooh.
Yeah, I saw many monarch t-shirts, monarch earrings, monarch crocs, monarch cloaks, like a butterfly cloak, even a monarch bow tie.
Stylish.
Yeah, yeah, maybe. The really interesting thing was it wasn't just a conference of scientists. It was a mix of researchers and lay people, everything from, you know, community scientists, people who volunteer to count monarchs at their local park and contribute that data to science, to master gardeners who grow gardens that are beneficial for the monarchs. Mm-hmm. I even met a woman who has a side business raising monarchs to sell for release at weddings and funerals.
Oh.
So lots of different people. And what's interesting was there were definitely some clashes at times. I don't want to make it sound too controversial, but there was more drama than I would have expected at a butterfly summit.
Like, what kind of drama? What kind of drama can happen at a monarch summit?
So one of the controversies was around the milkweed plant, which the monarchs use to lay their eggs on. Mm. And most scientists discourage people from planting milkweed near the coast where the monarchs spend their winter, because if it's there, it could trigger the monarchs to lay their eggs in the middle of the winter too early. But planting milkweed is this really tangible thing that people can do, and, you know, it makes them feel like they're helping. So some people were not happy to hear that they shouldn't be planting milkweed in coastal California, and they kind of pushed back against the scientists on that one. You know, I think this is what happens when you get people that are really enthusiastic and want to help in the room with scientists, trying to hash out what everyone can really be doing that's actually going to help.
Yeah. Okay, and then you said there was some really bad news.
Right, so the really bad news I do want to point out is that monarchs get a lot of focus. This is something I've reported on before. And while they are in decline, there are a lot of other insects that are doing a lot worse. So one researcher at the conference shared data from this butterfly-wide survey that happens in California. It's actually one of the longest-running scientific studies done by a single individual. Mm. This scientist, Art Shapiro, runs a transect across Central California. So it's basically this line from the Bay Area into the Sierra Nevada, and he travels travels along the line and counts butterflies at different points along the line.
Okay, what did that research find?
They found that at these sites, the monarchs are maybe doing like the 10th worst of all the butterflies there, right? It depends on the site. But the point is that a lot of butterflies are doing worse than the monarchs. Butterflies we don't really talk a lot about, like the large marble, which is this large white butterfly, or the common sooty wing, which is this kind of drab butterfly. It's maybe not as pretty as the monarch, but it used to be really common in the Central Valley, and now it's almost gone.
So is it, why are we focusing on the monarch? Because it's beautiful?
I think it's big and it's beautiful. It has this great migration story. It used to be really, you know, sort of easy and common to see. And I don't know why exactly, but it pulls on people's heartstrings. And I just think it's important to remember the big picture, which is that insect populations in general aren't doing well, and we need to be looking at why.
And what's the consequence of that?
So many things. Insects are hugely important, even though we don't think about them a lot, right? They're pollinators. They pollinate our food plants and our wild plants. Insects eat things that we want kept in check, and they're eaten by a lot of things, birds, bats, other mammals. Mm-hmm. And so it's just another example of the loss of biodiversity that we're seeing across the board, and monarchs are just one part of that.
Okay, well, thanks for keeping us updated on the monarchs, Marissa.
Of course. Thanks, Anna.
Marissa Ortega-Welch is our science reporter. You can find more of her reporting on monarchs online at klw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Next up, we've got a story from the Uncuffed team at Solano State Prison in Vacaville.
This is Uncuffed.
Stories from Solano State Prison.
Today's interview comes from Uncuffed producer Brian Tams.
Most of the stories that I've produced for Uncuffed have been of a serious nature, often dealing with personal issues of national interest. But this time, I wanted to do a lighter, more entertaining story about gangster arborist Jeffrey Mercado living that tree life.
Arborist is a tree cutter. He prunes trees, he cuts trees, he removes trees. It's all about trees. That's all our arborist.
Okay.
We don't cut lawns, we don't cut bushes, it's straight to the tree.
Not that there's anything wrong with cutting lawns or bushes.
No, of course, but a lot of people get it like mistaken. Oh, right, so you're a landscaper. No, arborist is a tree cutter, a tree pruner.
So you think you're better than a landscaper?
No, of course, we're way better, because we make a lot more money than cutting lawns, you know what I'm saying? So.
Okay.
Because, for example, the arborist, what he does, he climbs the tree, he cuts the tree, prunes the tree, throws the branches down, and then the ground guys are the ones that do the cleanup, for example, and we get the branches, cut them up to smaller pieces, load them up to the truck, or we have a grinder, a chipper, then we throw them in the chipper.
You used to be a guy on the ground too,
yes,
right?
Yes, that's okay. How you start. Everybody starts as a groundsman, so I was looking for a job. It was 2015, and I came across a guy, and he said he needed help. I pulled up on the guy, and he really liked the way I worked. He would pay me $100 cash. I started as a gopher. So go for this, go for that, do this, do that. I seen the guys, they started trimming the trees, and they started with the chainsaws, and I've always been a little crazy, and I remember the first time he let me finally climb. It was funny. It was like a 15-foot palm tree. Mm-hmm. He makes it look easy, but it wasn't easy. You know what I'm saying? My legs were shaky. I was trying to get up there. I was up there. I couldn't, you know, stay still. I mean, it's difficult. Sometimes things are easier. You see them easier than what it really
Wait
is.
Wait a minute. You know? You said a 15-foot tree, and you were...
Yeah, so then, yeah, I was, my legs were shaky, and I was
trembling. Wait a minute, man, but you're a tough guy,
yeah,
man.
I mean, I am a tough guy, but you have to master the art of, you know what I'm saying, like, of tree climbing because it's just, it's not that simple, you know? You gotta learn your knots and you gotta know your roping, you gotta know how to climb with the belt, and it's just more difficult than what it is. Being here in prison now, and I see a lot of people trying to be gangsters, and, and my mindset is, man, I could take you to this spot where I know you won't be gangster, and it's at the top of a 90-foot palm tree, you know? Because at that time when I climbed that 90-foot palm tree, man.
Tell me about it.
Halfway up, I slipped. And once I slipped, boy, I used all 20 nails on my body, including the feet, to grab onto the palm tree, you know? It was just the craziest thing. I probably said like 10 All Fathers, 10 Hail Marys.
So you really thought that moment you could have been out of here?
You know what? I've never talked to God so much in my life. For a second, it flashed in my mind, you know what? This job isn't for me. I gotta go, like the song.
I hear you, gangster.
You know, so I kind of just calmed down, calmed my breathing down, talked to God a little bit. And I'm a person where if I start something, I gotta finish it no matter what.
That was Jeffrey Mercado speaking with Brian Thames. Brian is a producer in KALW's radio program at Solano State Prison. Our work in prisons is supported by the California Arts Council and the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. The producers fact-check content to the best of their ability, and all content is approved by an information officer. You can hear more stories like that by subscribing to Uncuffed in your podcast player. And, of course, you're already subscribed to the Cross Currents podcast, right? Tune in tomorrow at 5. Another Silicon Valley mobile home park is in danger of closing.
I think the best path for us forward is the co-op. We need to own this land. That's our long-term solution.
The fight for affordable home ownership tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents. And before we leave you, here's some local music. This is Tribe Divine from Oakland. They're performing at the Golden Bull in their hometown this Wednesday.
Got trouble sleeping, overthinking, heart is weakened. I've been weeping, lost and seeking, saving beacon. There's no leaving what I reap in. I can't sleep, but it ain't the weekend. Sun is peeping, but I'm still deep in thought. Toss and turn and comfort yearning, restless burden. Prayers turning, hope they're working. Souls conflicted, minds conflicted, self-inflicted. Should be happy, feeling crappy. Fuck this feeling, got me reeling stuck. Takes me to war, and the only casualty is me. I'm alone in this for sure. You say you're always there, but I can't count on you no more. I'm too poorly for schooling, but I'm hurting to my core.
Today's Cross Currents team includes Sona Avakian, Janae Darden, Christopher Agusa, True Gwynn, Jessica Plachek, Andrew Stelzer, and Eli Wordchapter. Our engineers are James Rollins, Tariq Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shirin Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hainaut Baba.
I'm stressing and stressing. It's hard to see this a blessing. I should let it go, but will be more than a lesson. Is she with them right now? They just...